Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We Americans are facing big challenges these days. We have an authoritarian in the White House, a Congress controlled by Republicans, big money dominating our government for special interests, and a hostile foreign power, namely Russia, interfering in our elections. Many people are wondering, what happened? How did we get here? And what can we do about it? Here to help us figure this out today are two guests who are both leaders inside government and among progressive activists. First is Donna Edwards, a lawyer and community activist who served as a congresswoman from Maryland from 2008 to 2017, being the first African-American woman to represent Maryland in the United States Congress. Congresswoman Edwards is now a candidate for local office in Maryland. Following her will be State Senator Daniel Squadron, who left the New York State Senate to become executive director of a new group called Future Now, working to advance a bold progressive agenda for the states and supporting candidates for state legislature. First up is Congresswoman Edwards, who I knew before she ran for office and have great admiration for all that she's done. Congresswoman Donna Edwards, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Yes, and I'm so excited that you're running for office again, and I find it fascinating that you had kind of gotten into the high level of member of Congress, and now you're running to be county executive for Prince George's County in Maryland. So can you explain to our listeners, why are you running for that position?
Sure. I mean, you know, it's evidence that we actually, I believe that as progressives, we need to contest up and down the ballot every single elective office. And so when I came out of Congress, I thought about it for a little bit and decided that I really could make a contribution right here where I live at the county executive level, doing things that are incredibly progressive in a county that really can take it. And so I'm really excited about that. And I think that when we, you know, run for local office on the ground where people live their lives and not just the, you know, the potholes and the trash pickup, but things like, are our schools working? What's our tax base? Are we, you know, growing our economy in a way that lifts everybody up? And these are things that I feel like I can do and use my experience from Congress, from the nonprofit and private sector, which I worked in for almost 30 years before coming to Congress. And so it really excites me. And I think if you look across the country, what you can see is that particularly progressive candidates are stepping up at every single level because we realize that it's not just about federal office. It's not just about the House and the Senate in the White House. Those state houses matter. Those cities matter. The municipalities matter. And, of course, school boards and local government.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm excited you're bringing your expertise and your experience and your wisdom and your judgment and your progressive values to have that influence at the local level. And I think you can get maybe way more done as the county executive at Prince George's than maybe you could if you were in this house right now, the U.S. House, which seems to have become a new level of dysfunctional. And you know, it was very interesting when we talked recently, you mentioned about spending 3 months traveling alone after you left Congress in areas that voted for Trump, including the Deep South. And I'd love for you to share with our listeners, what did you learn from talking to Trump voters? What do you see? Like, why did people vote for this guy?
Well, so, you know, after the election, I did. I got in my RV, and I started driving all across the country. And, in fact, by the time it was over, after 3.5 months on the road, I had logged in about 12,000 miles and 27 states. And, you know, when you stay in RV parks in particular, it's a really different culture, even from staying in places where people put up tents. And so I talk to people on a very human level about their hopes and dreams and aspirations. One of the things that I discovered, frankly, is that once you get past the layers of, you know, the group of folks who are racist and xenophobic and homophobic and sexist and all of those things, you actually find a group of people, I think, who voted for Donald Trump who are movable because they care about jobs and their communities and the direction of the country. They care about whether their kids are going to a good school and whether they're not living in their home and they are preparing for their retirement. And I believe that these are issues on which Democrats really can unite rural voters and urban voters for that new American future. And my travels along the road, and I was in deep south in the Black Belt of Alabama through northern Louisiana across to the borders and Texas and Arizona. And I just learned so much from people about what connects us as human beings. And I think, again, you know, that segment of Trump voters who are all of those isms, you know, forget them. Let's talk about the group of people who really share hopes, dreams, and aspirations as Americans. And I think that we can unite around a truly progressive agenda that raises wages. A lot of people on the road talk to me about, you know, how they're just not even making enough to make a living. Some people were living in their RVs full time because they really couldn't afford to live in their homes anymore. They had lost their health care. And what was startling to me is the number of people I talked to who had signed up for Obamacare. And these are people who didn't like Obama, didn't vote for Obama, hated the Affordable Care Act when it was passed, but they signed up for it, and guess what? They liked it. And so I knew around, you know, January, February, when I was out on the road, that's a law that's here to stay and that it would be really difficult to get rid of it because people were signed up, they were getting health care for the first time, and they, you know, they felt safe and comfortable for themselves and their families.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I love what you talk about, forgetting about the isms of, you know, the racism, the sexism, all the rest of it, and focus on our shared hopes and dreams. And I think you're really speaking to something about a common ground that's there, because we keep hearing the media tell us how polarized we are, and certainly we all see that even in our families. Very strong differences of political views. But I agree with you. I think underlying that, we essentially all have the same hopes and dreams. We want good schools for our kids. We want to retire in dignity. We want to be able to live safely with, you know, without having crime or without toxins destroying our water. So I think you're really onto something about the common ground that's there.
Well, and you know what? We're not going to win over. I mean, I'm tired of trying to convince them. We're not going to win over the isms people. And so I'm not interested in that. But I am interested in how it is that we can have a conversation that unites concerns across rural and urban and suburban areas. It's really about that, you know, those common bounds. And, you know, I met, you know, people who had come, came from like completely different places than me. And you know what? We could sit across a picnic table out watching a sunset and actually talk about our families and about our children and about what we wanted to do in retirement and about the things that bug us and the things that don't. And most people didn't think about politics in the kind of partisan way that I had gotten used to in my service in Congress in Washington. Even people who came from, you know, deep into Trump country, it's not really what they think about every day. And they just want government to work for them. They want it to function for them on the things that they're concerned about. And so it was very exciting to me to do that and to be reminded about who we are.
Right. That's great. And, you know, when you're talking, I'm reminded of the woman, Arlie Hochschild, who spent a long time traveling around Louisiana and checking in and having conversations with the Tea Party advocates, trying to understand how can be people be voting against their own interests. And she wrote a book about it called Strangers in Their Own Land. And what she saw was, you know, similar to what you're doing, maybe a little bit different, that people felt that the government was kind of harassing them about maybe some local ordinance or some regulation about fishing or whatnot, but they were letting the big guys get away with polluting the water down there and that kind of a thing, and that people actually benefited from government, so they know that through the Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security, but they really felt that government had been kind of hijacked by the wealthy donors. And I'm hearing a very kind of similar assessment from you, that people really want the government to work for them, and they don't see anymore, like we took for granted from FDR and all the liberal programs that came in, that the Democrats stood for helping the low-income people versus the Republicans who were supporting the big business, but that in the past several decades, that line has blurred, and people don't necessarily see Democrats as helping them against big business. What do you think about that assessment?
Well, I mean, I think that there's something to that, because one of the you know, sort of messages that I heard consistently was, I voted for Donald Trump because he wasn't a Republican and he wasn't a Democrat. And it was almost like the pox on both your houses. And so they were lumping the Democratic Party in with the Republican Party because it was about money. And, you know, as I traveled through state parks and national parks, and I would, you know, park in these RV, you know, campgrounds, I would talk to people, and they loved the outdoors. They loved the idea that they could enjoy the mountains and the streams, and that there was clean water and fresh air. And they didn't totally connect that was because we had protected the air and the water from the Clean Water Act to the Clean Air Act. They didn't get that, you know, we had protected all of these beautiful, pristine spaces because there was a vision about a National Park Service that began up in the Badlands, you know. And so I think that as a Democrat, I feel like I have to do more, whether it's in my community or across the country, in helping people understand the positive role that government plays in their lives, and that they actually connect the benefits they see with the good that government does. I mean, keep in mind that we have had, you know, 30-plus years of a Republican Party that has been just bent on destroying the state and tearing down every part of government and saying that there's nothing that government can do that is right. That's a lot to push back against, but we have to start pushing because otherwise we run the risk of losing it all.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, we do see that people don't really want to hear so much about here's my 10-point plan and my agenda for what to do, that they don't actually believe anymore that government can do anything that's going to really help them. And what you're talking about is showing where government actually does help them and has a positive role in their life, that yes, we have protected the clean water. We are protecting the air. We've reclaimed water in many places. So to talk about the good that has done and that we can do more like that, that directly affects their daily lives, I think people need to see that in order to believe again that government can do anything that really helps working people.
And we have to talk in language that people understand. And so, you know, if we talk about, you know, keeping a stream, you know, clean so that somebody can go, you know, catch and release trout fishing, or, you know, the mountains so that you can actually see on a clear day miles and miles of, you know, of blue sky and, you know, and mountains, that actually is about climate change. But when we call it that, it's almost like we push aside a whole set, you know, set of folks. And so I think that we also have to learn the language that people are speaking and the way that they understand their world and their, you know, and their community and their environment. And we're not so good at that. And also we're, you know, pretty bad at lecturing people about how they should live their lives instead of living by demonstrating and by incorporating the ways in which people already do live. I mean, people are working incredibly hard. I mean, I met, you know, folks out on the road who are, you know, working not just one or two, but three jobs at minimum wage. And it's not like living in some places where, you know, they're talking about raising the wage to $15 an hour. It's about living in places where the wage is $7.35 an hour, and they're struggling. Mm-hmm. You know, people who, you know, actually got health care. I talked to one woman, you know, who is out in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and she had gotten health care for the first time, but she voted for Donald Trump, and she told me, she said, but I didn't think he meant it when he said he was going to take away my health care. She thought that she was still going to be able to keep it, and that's not why she voted for Donald Trump. Or, you know, the family who, you know, who is in Southern Illinois, whose son, I met a family whose son was a deputy sheriff, and he was shot in a small town serving a warrant. And they wanted to know that somebody was out there caring about their son. Well, those are, you know, American values. Of course we, you know, can identify with that. And of course, as Democrats, we're not enemies of law enforcement. We just want law enforcement to behave properly in all of our communities. And so I think being able to share some of those conversations, and for me to hear them more directly, and people would say to me, so funny, they would say things like, well, you're not really a politician. It's like, well, yeah, I am. No, but not like those other politicians. And, you know, we've become so divorced from our politics and our local politics. I mean, our members of Congress going out to the grocery store and buying a, you know, a carton of milk and some eggs so we know how much things cost, so we understand the lives that people are living and the struggles that they're enduring.
Right. That's wonderful. And are you, I know you're busy running for office right now, but are you going to write up anything of what you learned on the road? I mean, what you're saying is so rich and is really needed to help guide Democrats at the state and federal level this year in these important races happening.
Well, I kept an amazing diary in the time that I was on the road, and I was by myself, and so I had a lot of time. I did some coloring books, and I kept some notes, and I've begun to write up these stories, and I hope to compile it in a way that people can take it in. I also, in a couple of stretches of the road trip that I've done, took a couple of film crews with me, and so, you know, we're trying to make sure that those can get produced so that we can really tell the richness of the conversations that we had. And I'm not, you know, look, I'm not Pollyanna. I don't think that there aren't people out there who, you know, harbor resentments against people of color and people who are different because they do. But I do know that there is some richness in America that's, you know, evidence in our diversity in geography, our diversity in people, the diversity in states, that it's worth remembering and reminding ourselves.
Right, absolutely. Well, if someone wanted to help support this film, how would they get in touch with you, or who do they get in touch with to back it?
Well, I've been working through the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., but people can write to me. I, you know, see my email, and it's at Donna@DonnaForPrinceGeorge.org. And if you just look up Donna Edwards and Google me, you're gonna find me. And people have written to me on Facebook, and I've responded to them and, you know, contacted them directly. But, you know, I would love to have support for this project, because I think especially going into an election year, it's really important for us to have a deeper understanding of the electorate all across the country and to be able to connect the common concerns so that we're not constantly dividing the issues and interests of rural and urban communities, you know, around addiction and drug treatment, around jobs and, you know, the loss of manufacturing jobs, and all of these things really connect our communities. And so, you know, if somebody wants to contact me, you know, contact me on Facebook. I'm Donna F. Edwards on Twitter. I'm on all of the social media. It's not hard to find me, and I will definitely respond to you, because, you know, all we need is about $60,000 to finish this project, and it will be so rich to show the rest of the country and to share with some of my former colleagues in Congress as well.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And, you know, we have a number, obviously we have like 22,000 women now running for office at different levels, just like a real breakout year for women running at the local, state, and federal level. And if you had like 2 minutes to talk to them and kind of summarize and guide them, you know, what would you say to these candidates now based on your experience of having been in Congress, you're experiencing out there in the RV talking to people about why they voted for Trump and what we need to do? What would you say to the candidates running right now this year? What do they need to do to win people over?
Well, I think, first of all, they have to be authentic, and they have to tell their own stories as a way to relate to the stories that they're hearing. And they have to be willing to listen and listen to the critique and listen to the skepticism and to meet that head on. And I would say, you know, mostly you just have to be yourself. We all have stories and experiences. You know, oddly for me, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis about a year and a half ago. And so when I was on the road, I hadn't really talked about it very much. But then when I met people and they shared with me, you know, their healthcare experiences and, you know, challenges, I actually felt like I could share it with them too. And you know what? That was something that united us. And so we were concerned about the cost of prescription drugs and, you know, of seeking medical care and whether there was enough money going into, you know, into research. And so I would say, you know, to candidates out there, you know what? I've run races and some of them I've won and some of them I've lost. And either way you get knocked down, you just get right back up. But be your authentic self, because people will recognize in a heartbeat if you're not your true self.
Right. That's all excellent advice. And everything you were talking about earlier in this conversation was speaking to the issue. Like right now, the Democrats seem to speak very well to kind of maybe middle and upper class, college educated in the cities, which is where most people live in the cities, but really not speaking as effectively as need to in some of the lower income urban areas, and almost not at all to the rural or exurban areas, which feel completely bereft, like, you know, they don't think the Democrats are speaking to them at all. Like you mentioned on our call the other day, the Democrats may say, yes, we want to work towards loan forgiveness for college students, which is very important, but then you have something like the over 70% of people who don't go to college. And what are we going to do to make sure that they get good training, maybe in a trade or some other way that they can get education and training that they can earn a living? So we need to be mindful of who we're actually talking about when we're talking about our program of action.
Well, I think that's right. And I mean, look, I believe in, you know, in working toward, you know, college loan forgiveness and things that are going to prepare people to go on to, you know, be successful in four-year institutions. But the fact is the overwhelming majority of Americans actually, you know, graduate high school and go right out into the economy, or they go into a trade school. We have to be able to speak that language. And that's the language of rural America, but it's also the language of urban America. And so if you want to ask, you know, why it is that we had so much trouble turning out the vote in cities like Philadelphia and, you know, down in cities in, like Raleigh in North Carolina and, you know, across in Milwaukee. Well, the reason is because we're speaking way over people's heads and their life experience, and we need to stop doing that. And that doesn't mean that we abandon the idea that, you know, college should be a dream for those who want to go, but we have to recognize where people are living their lives, and they're not living at 30,000 feet. They're living 1 foot planted above the other on the ground. And I think until we do that, you know, we will continue to have a situation where, you know, our rural voters go with the other guys and our urban voters just go, they're not speaking to me, I'm just going to stay home. Well, we can't afford that, and especially in 2018, which is such an important year. And I would say, you know, the importance of the year isn't just about Congress. It's about all of those state legislatures that are going to redraw the lines for the districts in for after the 2020 census, that's going to have a deep impact on all of our lives for the next decade or two. So we have a lot at stake, and we can't get from here to there by speaking above and over people.
Exactly right. And one of the big concerns that comes up, and you know, people have a hard time getting past this one, but and most Americans see that there's such dramatic influence of the top 1% on our government, you know, the wealthy donors, the big business, and that's what's kind of setting the agenda in Congress and increasingly in the states. How did you see the influence of big money when you were in Congress, and what do you think we can do to address that major concern that really has a lot of people tuning out of politics because they feel powerless in the face of all that money?
Well, you just take one issue that impacts people so tremendously, and it is the major driver of the upward drive of healthcare costs, and that's prescription drugs. And there is almost not an office holder that the pharmaceutical industry does not contribute heavily to. And that keeps us from doing things like, you know, shooting for negotiating prescription drug prices so it lowers the prices for all of us. On the issue of gun violence, look, I actually, you know, when I was out, I had, you know, great experiences with people who are hunters and shooters and, you know, gamesmen. And that may not be for everyone, but those are not people who want to go out and get a handgun and use it in the commission of crime. We have to be able to distinguish those things as Democrats. And yet the National Rifle Association has really controlled the agenda, you know, has controlled the entire footprint of legislation, because I think that, you know, we have to have a language that allows us to communicate that we understand the difference between somebody who wants to illegally get a gun and go out and do great damage versus somebody who, you know, like my cousins, who want to go deer hunting.
Right. Exactly right, and well put. And I think also we're seeing an upsurge now. People are understanding that part of how you counter big money is with big action, that if all of us get involved and all of us vote, we really can make a difference. If you look at the recent elections in the Virginia state legislature, in New Jersey, even in Alabama for the Senate race, people got out, they organized, and they voted, and getting whole new blood in, new people who are not your typical up the ranks kind of politicians, but you know, regular people from the community running and winning. And that it seems like that's the best way to counter the big money is for all of us to vote, because why do politicians want the money? It's so that they can speak to the voters and win their elections. But if they see they need to actually be free of the big money to get our votes, that's the way they're going to move, don't you think?
Well, I think so, and I think it also will create an environment for reform of the campaign finance system and to, you know, end this pervasive influence of money on our politics. But I think you're right. I mean, and we'll prove it in 2018. We've got, you know, so many candidates running at every single level, and they're organizing in their communities. And the power of organizing can sometimes beat money. And so I'm really looking forward to that. You can see the energy level across the country is just over the top. And, you know, I just hope that we can maintain that same energy level from now until November. I'm convinced that we can, because people really do want to grab a hold of their politics and pull it back so that it, you know, so that it's not so damaging as it has been. And, you know, and of course, you know, the president and his actions, I mean, he's a great motivator. But we can't just run against the president. We also have to stand for something.
Absolutely, and you've laid out a great program of action of what we stand for and our values, and unfortunately, that's all the time we have. You are a true inspiration. I'm thrilled you're running for office. I encourage all our listeners to check you out. You say social media or on the Google, Donna Edwards. Congresswoman Donna Edwards, thank you so very much for being with us and for your leadership for the country at our dark hour. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.